Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Ja vasen nopee, suppuu.
Oh, löi käsille.
We have no power steering. We have no power steering after 13 kilometers of stage. No power steering.
What's wrong?
No guess, no power steering. And we have two long stages to go. I'm fed up with this car.
I don't understand. We had, should be no rain. I took the hardest tire and...
Oh.
Like driving, you know, in the trousers all the time. This is not nice.
Welcome to the latest edition of Spin the Rally Pod. There may be no action out on the stages, but we've still got plenty of rally conversation to bring you. We are all in our usual splendid isolation, which is what some people say is the best for all of us to be kept apart. But we bring you together via the glories of technology. I'm Lisa O'Sullivan, and I'm currently in the southeast of England, looking out in the garden and very, very pleased to have got away from digging lots of compost. I'm so glad to be talking about rallying. Also on the line, we've got the... I'm trying to think of a good word for you, Colin. I'm just going to call you Colin yes. Clark.
Hi, Lisa, yeah.
We've got David Evans and George Donaldson. All of you guys can come up with your own fantastic descriptions. But we're going a little bit different this time. We're not going to talk about what's happening in the world at the moment. We're going to look back in time. And we've decided to pick some of our rally heroes of the past. And we're going to start with the absolutely fantastic, the one and only... Marcus Ulf Johan Gronholm. I had to look that up, guys. Born on February the 5th, 1968. Great rally driver. Discuss.
Can I start, guys? Am I allowed to start?
Yeah, I think Fire you should, away. George.
Okay, so my history with Marcus is fabulous. And I could talk about Marcus for hours, but I would rather he was involved in the conversation, of course. Maybe we should get him along because he'd be a willing participant, of course. Marcus, my first experience with Marcus was in Toyota team back in 1991. But Toyota's experience with Marcus goes back before that, and it goes back to my boss at Toyota, which was Uwe Andersson. And Uwe Andersson, I think, was a very good friend of Marcus Gronholm's dad, who was a factory driver for, I can't remember, various teams. I can't remember all the events he was involved with, but anyway, I think that Uwe Andersson might have been Marcus's godfather. And anyway,
wow.
The result was Marcus was an up and coming driver. Uwe Andersson was a lovely man, tough operator at times, but he looked after Marcus and gave him opportunities and generated opportunities. And Marcus got an opportunity to drive what was actually a bit of a pig of a car in 1991. The 1991 Toyota Celica GT4 wasn't the best version of the car we had in any of the years. And it was a year where we had been world champions we had world champion driver in 1990 with Carlos Sainz. He failed in 91 to get the championship. The car was a wee bit difficult to drive. And, of course, they got it in 1992. That was Carlos's two world championships. But we're not talking about him. Marcus Gronholm was gifted a drive in Finland because the car was a bit difficult to drive. It was running a blocker in it, as I recall, in 91. So it was just straight four-wheel drive. We couldn't. The engine power had gone up so much in the preceding year that the hydrostatic four-wheel drive system really couldn't cope with the power differential, so the way we could make the car go quickest was with a blocker. Now, we ran blockers in the WRC for a short while, and then we've gone back to the electronic and the hydraulic diffs again. So so that was Marcus Gronholm. We got brought in, and he went incredibly well. But my very first memory of him was the last service, at the end of the last stage. Well, it wasn't the last service. It was the first service after the last stage of the first day of Thousand Lakes Rally, and it was dark because it ran up till late at night. Marcus came out of the stage. He'd been upside down and through the woods. And he brought this wrecked car out, and he was the same size then as he is now, all gangly and young and keen and enthusiastic, and he came leaping out the car at the stop line, having spotted me and a gentleman called Kevin Verite, I think it would have been at the end of the stage. And Marcus was flying over the bonnet and asking us what to do and this and that and the next thing. We were on the radio to the chief engineer, Pepper, saying, OK, Pepper, this is the situation. We can patch it up and it'll take 3 or 4 minutes to get it patched enough to get it into main service where the main group is. It was only, I think, maybe 15, 20 kilometres away. So that's what we did. We went underneath the car, made sure all the wheels were going to stay attached and made sure it wasn't leaking too much water. I think we stemmed one oil leak that out of a heat exchanger at the front. And sent him on his way, and Marcus was leaping around. And if you imagine Marcus with no filters at all at his most young and crazy, that's my memory, and it was just a special. Marcus, get back in the car and go. Are you sure? Is it okay? Thank you. And jumps into the car, and you say, Marcus, look, take it easy. You know, your wheels are all pointing the wrong way. Be a wee bit careful. I think he had one front brake was gone or something like that as well. Just take your time. It's okay. Main service. And don't worry. I mean, at that time, service wasn't timed. So you had a generous road section and you would probably get, you know, 45 to 50 minutes service potentially before penalty lateness. And that was Marcus. And then we went in and the rest of that event's a blur for me. I think he finished 14th or 15th at the end, but he had been doing incredibly well earlier on. I tried to check out some times.
George, what I find really interesting about that story is that a lot of us who perhaps weren't quite around in those days, or certainly weren't quite the aficionados of rally that you are, the assumption is that Gronholm really didn't make it. He didn't appear on the scene until his latter years. But from what you're saying, he was always on the radar, even in his early 20s.
Well, I mean, seeing as we're starting off at the beginning, so Marcus got that opportunity and went very well. So what he did was, Uwe Andersen lent him a car. So he effectively rented a car from us. Now, Toyota didn't rent cars in those days, so this was a special. But basically, the car was given to Toyota Finland. And we did the same with Sweden, and we did the same with Australia and other things. We rented cars to them, very, very advantageous rates.
George, just a quick question. Would that have been a proper sort of factory car?
Was it exactly
the same spec as a Carlos car or one of those kind of cars?
The ones used locally, they might not have quite had the latest, should we say the highest spec engine tuning in them, because obviously those engines might only do, you know, 800 or 900 competition kilometres, because that's what we did in those days, 800 to 1,000 kilometres in an event. We could do up to that. So there was I think we called them A engines and B engines. And I think there was also recce engines as well. So these guys would have had B engines. Now, they were exactly the same as the A engines, but when they got put onto the dyno in at Cologne, and we had the most wonderful engine department, and they were so diligent. It was run by fantastic engineers, whom I will not name, in order to protect them. But then coming down the rung, you know, the workshop was managed by a fantastic chap called Gert Dix, who ran that place with such diligence and precision. He still builds lots of
George.
Toyota engines. Yes.
George, it's all lovely, George, but we're talking about
Gronholm. Oh, we're getting to the engine.
Maybe TTE.
We're getting to the engine.
Maybe TTE is something.
So the point being was, yes, the engine was very, very similar to the one that you would get on the event. It might have been 10 horsepower down. Therefore, it didn't make the A grade. It was stuck in the B grade. So that was Gert. he would have had those engines sorted out like that. So it would have been a B-spec engine, and it would have been good for, you know, a couple of thousand kilometres, I guess, David, as a result.
Right.
So that's what he got.
We're talking about, we need to move much more on to... We are a little short of time, okay. George. So much more on the Marquis. So as you mentioned there, Colin, perhaps I think the biggest thing I find with Marcus Gronholm is I don't feel he ever got the credit, really, for how good he was when he was competing. But he was a driver who was always within a handful of points the great Sebastian Loeb by the end of the season. And do you think he really has the credit he deserves?
Yeah, do you know what? It's a difficult one, that, because I think most people appreciate Gronholm for what he was, and he was just the most supremely gifted driver. Yeah, he probably would have won in a different... It's difficult to say, you know, because if he'd gone back 10 years, there were a lot of drivers around capable of winning. He then found himself in between that generation and the dominance generation, which was Loeb and then obviously Ogier. But, you know, I think Gronholm was unique. Gronholm was quite different. He was a Colin McRae-style driver in that he really did put it all on the line. With a character to match, and quite an unfinished-like character at times, David. He spoke his mind, he said some very entertaining things, and if you look on YouTube, there's roll after roll of video there of Gronholm quotes. But whether he was given credit or not, I think he probably is. I think people do appreciate just how brilliant a driver Gronholm was. But on top of that, you know, they remember him as being just, you know, a fantastic rally man. Fantastic rally man, a fantastic rally character, and a wonderful champion for the sport, David.
Absolutely. But, you know, for me, I think actually he kind of was at the sharp end when the sport was in one of its golden generations. Mm. You know, he won his first championship 20 years ago in 2000, and the greats were all still there. Carlos was there, Tommy was there, Kankinen was there. They were all there, but... There's certain events that you can kind of look at and pick out and think, yeah, you know, that shows a driver's greatness. And, you know, perhaps when Loeb had come along, maybe I think Gronholm had actually gone past his absolute best. But looking back, you know, to 99, you know, before that Peugeot came along, he did two events. He did the Swedish in the Seat, which was, you know, it wasn't a great car. But then he got into the Mitsubishi, which, George, you'll be able to speak more eloquently about this. But that Mitsubishi, the Lancer, he drove the Charisma, of course, in Portugal. It wasn't an easy car to drive. You know, we'd seen so many drivers struggle with it. Okay, Bernsey was great in it. And, of course, Tommy was a legend. It was Tommy's car. But to get into that car, and, George, can you explain just briefly why that car was difficult and how Gronholm could get into it and almost be quickest? And the gearbox broke, and he didn't finish. But that was one of those events early in his career. He was like 30 or something, but still he hadn't done so many events. But it was a show that he had something, and of course he was then on his way to Peugeot anyway.
Well, I mean, I was alluding to that when you bulldozed over me and jumped forward 10 or 12 years earlier.
George,
we don't have the rest of the day to get through your 12 years.
I've been thinking about this for minutes. It's going to be concise now. So, 1991 to 95, Marcus drove up to 98. He drove Finnish Championship. He did the Swedish Rally, and he would pick one or two other WRCs a year that he could get finance for.
Georgie did the Scottish Rally in 94?
He might have done. I can't remember that. Was it Celica?
Yep. My first memory of him.
Wow.
I'm sure it was 93 or 94.
I wasn't here. So, look, he did what he could. And actually, we promoted him very heavily at Toyota. And when Phil Short left Toyota... He made a throwaway comment to the press. Phil Short was the team manager at Toyota. He made a throwaway comment, which Marcus was furious about. And Uwe Andersson was furious. And I, as one of Marcus's friends, was furious about. He said, well, Marcus is quite a good driver and he's able to go quite quick, but he'll never win anything. That was Phil Short's comment. Oof. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that put a damper on Marcus's career for another two or three years. When we got the Corolla up and running, Marcus got to come to the four again. and did very, very well on the very first outing of the Corolla. Ran out of petrol on the last day, where somebody had been dicking around with the fuel mappings. And I think also there might have been a mistake with the fuel tanking system as well. Anyway, he ran out of fuel, and that was his rally over, Thousand Lakes Rally 1997. But it did enough. It did enough. And this is the best story of all now. So now this is the gold story from this whole thing. There's more. But basically, at the end of that event, everyone was thinking, oh, yeah, Marcus, once again, you know, not actually managing to win very much. But our press guy, a guy called Gwyn Dolphin, a very good friend of mine, he put out the story that Marcus was going to be employed full-time by Toyota, and which was not the case, because Uwe was set on having, despite being a big supporter of Marcus, he had money for two drivers, and he was going to take Didier Auriol, and he was going to take Carlos Sainz. That was his target. So we put this story out. We leaked it out to a particular person in the press who was a bit free with his tongue. And within an hour of leaking that story out, that Marcus was going to be signed to Toyota, this story came back to us. Somebody totally different came out. Is it true you're signing Marcus? Well, we're not at liberty to say yet, but certainly it's being discussed. And all of a sudden, that ignited the interest from all the other teams in Marcus. By Monday morning, that was on a Sunday afternoon, by Monday morning, Marcus had phone calls and was being flown to ProDrive, to M Sport, to Peugeot. He had offers from everyone, and I think even Seat at the time. He got all those offers coming in, and away he went and was feted. And again, it came back to us. He really wanted to drive the Toyota. But the funny thing about that whole situation was that Uwe Andersson got tangled up and decided he should also be wanting to sign Marcus Grönholm up. actually, I think that wasn't 97. I think that was actually 98. I think it was. It was 98. So he did that first, similar the following year. It was 98. And that was when Peugeot was just coming up. And I had to sit there as team manager of Toyota, and then as a friend say to Marcus, look, it's Peugeot. Look at what they did before. You know, when they came in before with the T16, they came in for 4 or 5 years. They blew everything away. They resourced it properly, and they did a great job. And we were at that time not sure whether we would continue past 2000. As it was, we ended in 1999. So we had said to Marcus, look, go to Peugeot, do your build-up year with the two-wheel drive car, and when it comes out to the four-wheel drive, you'll just blow everyone away, because the other guys that are being employed by Peugeot are going to be fighting amongst themselves, which was absolutely true. Gilles Panizzi and François Delacour, they just fought so much, Marcus came through and stole the limelight from them. So that was Marcus. That was his route to getting a factory drive. I instigated some of it along with colleagues, and of course, Marcus's brilliance.
Can I ask you about, we all know that the difference between rally drivers and other common or garden drivers is their mechanical skills as well. Can we talk about Marcus the mechanic? Because I remember, and I can't remember which event it was because I have a terrible memory, but I think it might have been Greece in the mid-noughties, where a lot of the drivers were having problems with their brakes burning out. So Marcus's solution was to change his brakes at the end of every stage, and he was getting a little bit tight on various time elements because he wasn't just swapping the tyres around, he was changing the brakes as well.
I have no recollection of that, Lisa. That was news to me. I wouldn't have known that Marcus was a brilliant mechanic, because nearly all my discussion is with Marcus is have been in bars or restaurants or in the back of motorhomes discussing tactics and strategy for stages. I know he's all fingers and thumbs in some ways, but
maybe I've got the wrong.
He's also,
my memory's terrible.
He's also absolutely brilliant at managing what he's got. You know, he'll drive a three wheeler, a bit like Juha Kankinen. You know, he'll drive a three wheeler and still get a fast time. Carlos Sainz was another one that could do that.
Which we've got to just say, George, you've talked about three wheels there. We really have to reference that conversation he had with the Welsh Constabulary when he really did feel he could make it back to service. But I can drive. It was another classic, wasn't it?
It was absolutely TV
gold. And no doubt,
he would have been
probably quicker down that bit of road on three wheels than the policeman on four.
That poor policeman just was terrified to leave because Marcus wouldn't take no for an answer. It was the funniest bit of TV ever.
It was a great quote, wasn't it? Yeah, you can't drive that car like that on the roads. Yes, I can drive that car. You just won't let me drive it.
I think the policeman deserved actually a sainthood for that whole thing in reality. It was a wonderful little bit of miscommunication, and it just played out so well.
I think, you know, that 206, we talked earlier about drivers, you know, their cars. We saw it, you know, with McRae in the Impreza 555 and with Loeb in various Citroens. For sure, 2000, that Peugeot, the 206 WRC, that was Grönholm's car. He got in there and he just made it his, didn't he? And it was rare to find a driver just settle down and get on with it so quickly. Yeah. I mean, within, he won Swedish, didn't he? A second.
Yep.
They all had the problem, didn't they, on the Monte in 2000, where all of the cars failed to start. They wouldn't come out of park firmly. That's right, isn't it, George?
That's quite you had the same problem. Quite a normal one. Subarus have done the same.
So, yeah.
Citroen did the same.
Citroen
2005.
Yeah, they've all had the cold start issues in Monte Carlo or in Sweden in the past. I think it was Sweden where the Subarus failed 1 year. It's just an inevitability. But going back to that, you know, Mark has been able to drive anything. David, you alluded to it earlier. He jumped into that Mitsubishi back in, was it 98 or something, 97 or 98?
99.
Was it? There you go. And basically, he went as quick as Tommy until he had, did he have a suspension breakage or a gear breakage?
I thought it was gearbox or something.
Maybe gearbox. Put him out of it, but went incredibly well immediately. You know, one of a handful of drivers to have managed that feat.
So, boys, I mean, you've seen a lot more of Marcus than I did. I mean, I came onto the scene, if you like, in 2005, which was unfortunately just at the back end of Marcus's career. But, David, what do you think it was that made him into such a great champion? What did he have about him? What was it about Grönholm that made him so capable of winning?
He had absolute raw speed, and he had complete compatibility with the car. And you know, George said it earlier, you know, he had the ability to drive around problems. And in all honesty, there weren't that many problems with the Peugeot. You know, he started winning in Sweden in 2000 and didn't seem to stop winning. Okay, there were issues, you know, when the next car came along, the 307, was it? Which, you know, was an awful pig of a car. But Grönholm, he had absolute speed, total commitment, and bags of talent. And you know, that compatibility with the car is everything to a driver. He knew when he got into it, he knew what it would do, he could second guess it, and when you've got confidence and comfort in a car like that, you know, driving on the limit almost comes naturally to a driver.
Just alluding back to the conversation from earlier, you know, someone said it was unfortunate that he came up against Sebastian Loeb. No, it wasn't. He was the only driver that ever took Sebastian Loeb head-on and repeatedly won and became a world champion against him. I know that Mikko Hirvonen would maybe be the guy that you would say that about, because he came up against Loeb when he was absolutely at his most supreme. But Marcus took him on, and Sebastian Loeb was really upset when Marcus retired, because he loved those fights, he loved that battle, and he knew he had give everything.
George,
We've got to jump back. I mean, to my mind, you know, Grönholm never actually beat Loeb, you know, across the spread of a season in a fair fight, because, you know, he won his last championship in 2002, and then Loeb came along really after that. But for me, the one that really showed that Grönholm could take Loeb was that year in New Zealand, when it was the
New Zealand.
In whatever
Absolutely.
Year it was, 6 or 7, I can't remember. And it was 7/10 of a second. Yep. That Marcus won by?
In the last stage, right in front of the service park. How good was
unbelievable.
That?
Unbelievable. Yeah.
It was incredible, because he had time to make up that morning, and he went into that last stage, and I think he was behind going into the last stage, wasn't he? And he had to win it on that, and it wasn't a proper stage. This was a stage around the service park. It was like a
Hampton
Downs.
Mickey
Mouse type
stage,
wasn't
it? Not Hampton Downs. What was the place?
No. It was
Hamilton. It was in Hamilton.
We were in Hamilton.
Agricultural park in Hamilton.
It was in the agricultural. Yeah. Correct. and he absolutely threw everything at it. And that
Mystery
was,
Creek.
Mystery Creek. Well done, you.
The mystery was
why
we were there.
Well done, your computer. It was New Zealand, wasn't it?
Yeah.
No, I remember being at that stop line, and it was one of the most magical moments. And you know, you saw emotion from Grönholm quite often. He wasn't one to hide his emotions. But my goodness me, they spilled out at that moment, didn't they? And he got on the roof of the car. He was punching the air. Yeah. He was jumping up and down. It was he knew he'd beaten, you know, possibly the greatest driver of all time in a straight fight. And it was magnificent.
Yeah, it was. It was. And it ultimately, I mean, it was for me, it was a real shame. The way in at the end of 2007, where the way Grom's championship challenges really ended, you know, he'd announced he was going to retire at the end of 07, and then he went into that Rally Ireland with a chance, but I think he had to win in Ireland against Loeb, and you know, it was a very, very difficult event. I can't remember the name of the stage or the lock or the lake or whatever, but he hit the wall, didn't he, side on.
Lochstrón,
a decent sized impact, wasn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, and that was the end of it.
Very sad.
It was, you know, because as much as I would love to have seen him take another championship in the early noughties, I'm not sure at the end of 07 that he really had another championship left in him. One of the absolute telling moments was at the end of Oinipoja in Finland in 07, when I think he just about beat Mikko in the same car. Mm-hmm. And this was the difference. At the end of the stage, Grönholm came through and he looked absolutely white. He looked terrified at what he'd had to do to bring the car through that quickly. And it was that year, I think, that you remember coming into Kakaristo, Mikko was in the ditch. The back of the car was in the ditch and he just kept it lit and it pulled it through. Mm. And the difference was Grönholm came through white, didn't want to ever go back down that road again. Mikko came through and he wanted to go straight back to the start and have another go. And Grönholm said to me at that point, you know, I think this is it. I think I'm done.
Well, I mean, at that point, Marcus had been driving World Rally cars for 16 years. Think how many frets. Yeah. That's 16 years worth of chances taken, you know. I guess you know as a driver when you've reached the limit, you know, because it's a numbers game. Eventually everything gets you.
Ah.
You know, it's like an aerobatic pilot. You know, there's old pilots and there's bold pilots, but there's not old bold pilots. And maybe that makes Marcus the smartest guy of all, because he retired when he did, pretty well at the top of the tree.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people as well, when pictures were scarce and we had to wait for 1 hour a week to watch rally catch up as well, Marcus on the radio has always been gold. And the most quirky stage end, we've spoken about the TV pictures that are on the internet, but the clicks, the noises we used to get from Marcus, it was just gold. Absolutely.
Again,
gold.
This is a whole load that we can't go without mentioning. We cannot go without mentioning Up in the Ass of Timo, which now features on a t-shirt at Rally Finland. Was it Cyprus, was it, or somewhere?
Cyprus or Turkey. Might have been Turkey.
Yeah, Turkey, that, yeah.
We have to stop because it came some stone or something through Timo's seat. Up in the ass of Timo.
Yeah, and the steel rod came up through the floor of the car and went quite literally up into the ass of Timo.
I've never asked exactly where that steel pole went, but quite clearly it didn't. I don't want to know.
George.
I really like Timo, and I don't want to know.
If you need to ask George, then you're struggling. You're struggling.
Somebody somewhere has kept that.
How does Marcus know that? I mean, did he get down there and have a look or what? I mean, honestly, I just don't want to know. Don't think about it.
But it wasn't just the actual words. It was the fist. Remember, he made the fist and he sort of thumped the fist just to really hammer the point home. Quite literally.
And I think on that note, it's a good time to draw a veil on the career of rally legend, rally man through and through.
That was only part one, Lisa. That was only part one. There's more.
We'll come back to that. Yeah, his dad was a rally champion, his son making a name for himself in rallycross now as well. So, yeah, a rally man through and through, Marcus Grönholm. And if you want us to talk about your memories of rallying, I think the best thing to do is send your questions to @VoiceOfRally. And David, what's your...
At
Twitter.
David Evans Rally or at Dirtfish as well. At, you can go to Dirtfish.
At Dirtfish. Let's go for at Dirtfish. That's the best way. So, yeah, ping your requests to at Dirtfish. And here on the Rally Pod, we'll do our best to try and cover subjects that might be of interest to you and keep you laughing over what can be very challenging times at the moment for everyone. But we'll be back very soon with another Spin the Rally Pod special. See you, boys.
See you, Lise.
See you, Lise.
Is that us done at the moment then, guys, is it?